the nation's capital. This is DC Public Safety. I'm your host, Leonard Sipes. We're doing a show, ladies and gentlemen, on human trafficking back at our microphones from the Urban Institute. We have Colleen Owens. She, again, is with the Urban Institute, did a heck of a program last time on the issue of human trafficking. Joining her today is Justin Bro and also Isela Banuelis. Did I get that correctly, Isela? And so I want to welcome all three of you to DC Public Safety.
Thank you.
All right. Now, we're going to go with Colleen because Colleen did the program before. And Colleen, give me a very quick overview of what it is that we mean by human trafficking.
Well, thanks so much for having us on the program, Len. We're really happy to be here. So human trafficking, as it is defined under our federal law, which was passed in 2000, essentially, you know, centers on the use of three elements of force, fraud, or coercion to compel a person either into, I guess, two very broad areas of labor trafficking or sex trafficking. If the person is under the age of 18, for sex trafficking, you don't have to prove force, fraud, or coercion. But for labor trafficking, you would.
It's, you know, I was reading the research report, and this is the one statement that just really jumped out at me. To a public largely unaware that crimes resembling slavery take place in America, is that overkill, or is that a justifiable description of what we're talking about when we talk about human trafficking?
I mean, that's absolutely justifiable. If you actually look at the root of the law that we have on human trafficking in the United States, it's based upon the 13th Amendment's principles of slavery. The language is actually directly related to the language that we have since the 13th Amendment around debt bondage, peonage, and slavery. And so what we're talking about is actually, you know, the limitation of a person's liberties and freedom. And this crime that we call human trafficking is somewhat new parlance since about the early 2000s, but it is a crime that has existed for a long period of time in the United States.
Now, we're talking about literally tens of millions of people throughout the world.
The best estimate that we have actually comes from the International Labor Organization, and their estimate is that 21 million people are victims of forced labor around the world.
And so, but we don't know the exact number of human trafficking slash slavery in the United States.
That's right.
But we do know that in all probability that millions are involved in this type of behavior in the United States.
Well, right. We don't have any estimates on the prevalence of human trafficking in the United States, but we do know that victims have been identified both of labor trafficking and sex trafficking across the country.
Because last time you and I did the show, in preparation for all my shows, I do talk to different people about the topic before actually doing the show. And to a person, they just said human trafficking in the United States. They found that incredulous. So they did not buy into the fact that there's human trafficking in the United States. So to satisfy them, once again, is there human trafficking in the United States?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So this is appalling. I mean, this is absolutely, literally appalling that we have forced labor and forced sexual bondage within the United States right now. And it's not all that unusual, nor is it all that rare, and it's probably happening throughout the country.
It's definitely, I would say that no community is immune to it.
You did a report, which I do want to cite, and I'll put it in the show notes, Understanding the Organization, Operation, and Victimization Process of Labor Trafficking in the United States. You did this, again, with the Urban Institute, coupled up with Northeastern University.
Right.
And so this, I've been seeing in my email, lots of material coming out of Urban on human trafficking. This is something that Urban is taking very seriously in terms of putting out seminars and reports on it. I mean, it's just not a one-shot deal. You guys are steadily pounding the streets talking about human trafficking.
Absolutely. It's an issue that we see as very central and important in the research field. And it's something that myself and my colleagues, Justin and Isela and Meredith Dank, also of Urban Institute, as well as my colleagues at Northeastern University, Amy Farrell and Jack McDevitt, have dedicated a lot of our time to conducting research on over the years. And it's something that we do feel strongly. There's still so much that needs to be known, a lot of unanswered research questions. And it's something that we do remember. remain committed to conducting research on in the future.
Isella, give me a sense as to the report. You talked to, 28 victims and 58 social service providers to get a sense as to what's actually happening in terms of human trafficking in not just in the United States, but throughout the world, but in terms of this report, particularly in the United States?
That's correct. So we talked to service providers and victims who have been able to get services. And we talked to people who were trafficked into various industries, including agriculture, domestic work, hospitality, and also
restaurants.
Thank you.
Okay. Right. These are people who are hiding in plain sight, according to the report. These are people who we interact with every day. We just don't know that they're being held in bondage, correct?
That is correct.
And it strikes me that there is a parallel here, and any one of you can enter into this conversation. I'm from the mainstream criminal justice system, and I have dealt with an awful lot of women who are caught up in the criminal justice system who we've supervised in my experience over the course of the last 25 years. And it's not unusual. There was a new piece of research out from one particular state where 85% of the women caught up in the correctional system had histories of violence and sexual violence before the age of 18. And so many of the women who are involved in the criminal justice system are there because, stereotypically, I understand, but it's true, some male has used physical force or threat of physical force or threat of economic force and basically told her, I've got 2 pounds of cocaine, you're going to drive it to New York City. They're going up Interstate 95, they get pulled over, the drug dog alerts on the car, and suddenly she's in jail or in prison for the next 10 years because principally she was forced to be there. It's sort of a type of bondage as far as I'm concerned. And you sit down and you talk with them about their backgrounds. It's verges on being disgusting. I get the sense that when we're talking about human trafficking, we're talking about basically the same thing. Force, threat of force, psychological bondage, people who feel powerless, and other people who take advantage of them. Justin?
And I think you'd want to add fraud in there. What we found was that in most of our cases, that was, you know, most of our survivors were heavily defrauded in terms of their interview, their recruitment, and things of that nature.
Okay. Am I overplaying my hand in terms of comparing human trafficking to what I see in the mainstream criminal justice system, in particular women offenders?
I think there are absolutely some similarities there. And in fact, in some of our cases, women came to the United States and, you know, they were working in homes. They were forced to board flights and really didn't have any choice in the matter.
Mm-hmm. So the bottom line and the heart and soul of all of these issues that we're talking about today is physical or psychological coercion, to coerce a person in terms of doing something by threatening them physically or threatening them psychologically. So that is a form of slavery.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But in terms of human trafficking, they're hiding, again, well, as we said, in plain sight. We interact with people on a day-to-day basis, but they don't feel that they can get out of it. The victims don't feel that they can escape it because they're not quite sure that the criminal justice system is going to be sympathetic towards their cause. Even though they're in the country legally, and I do want to get around to that part of it, mm-hmm. They feel that they're going to be deported. They think that terrible things are going to happen to them. Happen to their kids, happen to their families back in the countries that they came from, so they don't escape it. That is a form of bondage.
Mm-hmm.
Correct?
Right.
Talk
Absolutely.
To me about it.
I think we collected a lot of really interesting information around the escape experiences, and my colleague Isella can speak a little bit more on that. But you're absolutely correct that folks are laboring, you know, in plain sight oftentimes. They're working in hotels, they're working in construction and restaurants, they're here on a visa for work in these industries, primarily in our sample. That's what we found. and they're under threat of deportation, threat of being reported to the police if they complain. Their family members are being threatened back home because oftentimes they've been recruited back home in their countries of origin, and a lot of information has been collected about their personal background. So the traffickers use this against them.
I would also just add that in addition to having this threat of having their family members hurt in their home countries, I think that for folks who are coming into the country, authorized and unauthorized, there is this tremendous just fear of contacting law enforcement because of their visas. So contacting law enforcement would mean that they're jeopardizing their status. And so because they don't want to be able to, they don't want to be deported, then they are not contacting law enforcement.
But Justin, they're here illegally. And in not just the fact that they have visas when they come, but they paid.
Right. Exactly.
They paid to come here, and they paid quite a bit of money.
Right. And I think it starts with the recruitment phase. So we were looking at the continuum of the labor trafficking experience, and what we found was that it all begins with recruitment, oftentimes in their home countries. Through their social networks, they come across this opportunity. They usually meet with a recruitment agency. This agency will use high-pressure coercive tactics to convince them. Many times they're using fraud. The victims are paying large fees. On average, it was over $6,000. So, you know, that sort of sets the stage. And now they're in debt. They've used their family's money as collateral, and that really lays down the foundation.
They're here illegally, which meant they had to get visas, which meant they had to come in contact with the State Department.
Mm-hmm. Precisely.
So there was nobody at the State Department asking questions?
So that's we also highlight that in our report, sort of these interactions that are taking place. And what we found was that for many of the survivors that we interviewed, they had very routine sort of interactions with the State Department. Our survivors were often coached by their traffickers on what to say. Mm-hmm. In a few instances, the traffickers actually participated in the interviews with the victim and the State Department. And in that situation, the victim, you know, didn't speak English and really didn't say anything throughout the course of the interview. So we did find that the traffickers played sort of a critical part there. But we do want to add a little bit of a caveat in that, you know, we are looking at a subsample of the individuals who have sort of been victimized and received visas from the State Department. We don't know the universe of individuals who are at risk of trafficking who have applied for visas and been denied.
But you can only talk about what you know, I understand.
Correct.
But there's a certain point where we do need to extrapolate beyond your numbers to the larger issue. The criminal justice system doesn't come off very well in this report. You know, again, we are inundated with rapes, robberies, burglaries, what I call the garden variety types of crimes every single day. I've been in law enforcement. I've been in corrections. I understand the stresses and strains upon our system. If you came to me as a police officer and said human trafficking, I guess my response is going to be what?
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, I mean, I'm overloaded with the crimes, day-to-day crimes that people are very concerned about, and nobody at a community meeting brings up human trafficking.
Right.
Our politicians don't bring up human mm-hmm. trafficking. The media doesn't bring up human trafficking, and suddenly you present me with an extraordinarily complicated case where I don't know the law, I don't know the procedure, I don't exactly know what to do with this. All I see is a mountain of work. And, you know, when you're talking about a person being brought over and being worked half to death in a factory, I'm saying to myself, wait a minute, did you voluntarily come here? Do you have a visa? You went mm-hmm. through the State Department? You know, you paid for this, and your complaint is what? So
That's a very legitimate, you know, response and perspective, I think. You know, that's something that other research has been done on. Actually, NORC did a study a few years back that indicated that over half of law enforcement, including investigators and prosecutors that they surveyed, had no knowledge of the fact that their state had a law against human trafficking, and that there was a high level of misinformation around definition. So there, folks thought maybe trafficking equaled smuggling, that there had to be movement involved. And so I think that there's a lack of awareness, but I also think, and a huge need for training. But I also think something that's distinct for labor trafficking from sex trafficking that we found is that there's really a question about whose job is it to enforce the laws around labor trafficking.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, we found what I would call a black hole of enforcement. So, and it makes sense when you actually look at what we did in our study, which was we categorized and we reviewed cases of labor trafficking victimization and found that there were high rates of labor exploitation. So folks were experiencing crimes that, you know, sort of civil violations, rather, that fall under the jurisdiction of Department of Labor. So wage and hour violations, you know, denial of pay or, you know, failure to give someone a pay stub. You know, lack of meal breaks, for example, that is all under the jurisdiction of Department of Labor. What is under the jurisdiction of law enforcement are when it rises to a criminal level. So, you know, monitoring and surveilling your workers, basically using the threats, the violence, the coercion against them.
Human bondage is not a Department of Labor crime. I mean, what we're talking about are real crimes that we would define them as being real crimes. We're just a little confused when a person comes here voluntarily on a visa has been processed by the State Department, and we'd have one person's word against another. I mean, that's an almost impossible situation, but we're talking about real crimes. We're talking about real bondage. We're talking about sexual abuse. We're talking about rape. We're talking about some extraordinarily serious issues here.
Exactly. And I think, but I think Department of Labor is in a place where they could be doing more to help identify, because they are going into workplaces routinely. When you look at local law enforcement, your prior experience as, you know, law enforcement official, it's not really in the routine of law enforcement to be going into workplaces and looking for crimes, unless maybe somebody calls because they were assaulted, for example.
It's a fascinating conversation. We're more than halfway through the program, and these programs do go by very quick because, again, I find this to be extraordinarily interesting. The report, Understanding the Organization, Operation, Victimization Process of Labor Trafficking in the United States, is put out by the Urban Institute, www.urban.org, www.urban.org. Back at our microphones, we have Colleen Owens from the Urban Institute, we have Justin Bro, and we have Acela Banuelos. Am I getting it correct?
Banuelos. Yes.
Okay, thank you very much. And again, all from the Institute in conjunction with Northeastern University. Is this Department of Justice supported?
Yes, it was funded by the National Institute of Justice.
So the National Institute of Justice. Mm-hmm. So some rather prestigious organizations are involved in this. And I would imagine Justice is involved in this because they see a problem that nobody seems to be willing to deal with. Am I right or wrong?
Well, basically, this study came about because we've been, you know, the field has been doing research around human trafficking, I would say, for a little bit over the past decade. And what we've all sort of come to is that we know more, though we still need to know more, about sex trafficking, but we really don't know much about labor trafficking. Does this exist in the United States? What does it look like? How are people being victimized? And so this study came out of that question. And we knew that if we wanted to find, our approach was to find cases that have actually been identified and to study those cases.
You don't have an empirical base to make this statement, but I've read a couple of your reports now. Certainly it is justifiable to suggest that you're talking about a couple hundred thousand people, if not more, in the United States who are going through this problem, and it is criminal in nature more than it is labor in nature. I mean, I'm trying to set the stage for the person listening to this program who's trying to relate to this. Again, human trafficking, the conversation I had with other people, surprised that there's human trafficking in the United States. It impacts more than just a couple hundred people.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, some of the cases that we looked at, actually, we may have been reviewing, you know, the cases of one or two victims, but in fact, the actual labor trafficking case had hundreds of victims that were victimized through that one experience.
We have to somehow, some way, put some sort of, I mean, people are trying to wrap their heads around what it is that we're talking about, and they're sitting there now saying, well, this is horrible, this is disgusting, I didn't know about. But again, it's not really prevalent in the United States. It is. Is it not?
Well, we know that, you know, thousands of people have been identified that have been victims of labor trafficking. And I think based on what we found in our report in terms of how difficult it is for those folks that have actually come forward to come forward and all of the barriers that they face in doing so, it does raise questions about the extent to which this is happening. And I think also we looked at, I think what was surprising to me was how systematic a lot of this is, that it's, you know, a lot of the factors that are leading to the labor of folks and of workers being forced, you know, exist through a lot of these temporary work visa programs. Not to say that they should be canceled, but that we really need to, you know, have some serious oversight and look into making some adjustments around these programs to, you know, limit the risk that workers are facing coming in under those programs.
But, Justin, the bottom line is that we, within the criminal justice system, have got to start paying attention to this. It's got to be on our radar screen. We've got to be talking to our attorneys. We've got to be talking to experts. This isn't anything we can ignore. This is something that we should be paying attention to.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. And in our interviews with law enforcement, what we did find was, in fact, a lot of confusion about the issue. Oftentimes, they referenced it as being purely a labor issue.
Right.
So, yeah, there's a need there, and there's a need to raise awareness within the public as well.
And again, this is why I'm playing this card too many times, resembling slavery taking place in America. I'm trying to get a point across that we're not talking about somebody working 60 hours instead of 40 hours in a factory who's from another country.
So what we're talking about is, for example, in one of our cases, a woman made a mistake. She was a domestic worker. The family, the traffickers, said she made a mistake. She was not given food for 4 days. When she stole, quote unquote, two pieces of chocolate, she was forced to stand from 4 a.m. to 6 p.m. for the remainder of the day. Mm. So those are the type of situations we're talking about. Death threats, things of that nature. If you try to run, I will shoot you. I mean, these are things that sort of came out in our findings.
And again, this is something I think is just happening way too much in the United States. Sela, they got here from what countries? Principally what, Asia and Latin America?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. And they got here through visas?
Yes, the majority of the people in our sample came here through a visa, and 79%, I actually, don't quote
71%.
Yep. Yes.
Okay.
And they were flying in. I mean, if you're thinking about places in Latin America and Asia, these are folks who are coming in through.
They're not coming across the Canadian. They're not walking across the Canadian or the Mexican border. They are flying in with a visa.
That's correct, yes.
There's a certain point where most of their visas are now expired.
Yes, and that creates further challenges for escaping, right? So you have a situation where someone did everything right to come in through the country legally, and now they are caught in a trafficking situation, and their visa has expired. So that's just creating further challenges to contact law enforcement since they know that they are now unauthorized.
And Justin, go ahead.
One of the first things that the traffickers did upon arrival into the United States was to actually seize those documents, and that was one of their primary mechanisms of control over their victims.
All right. They believe because their visa has expired that they cannot go to law enforcement, they cannot escape because their visas have expired, they're simply going to be deported back to the countries that they came from.
That's one of the many challenges they have to overcome. And I think there's also, you know, physical barriers. You're talking about people who work in agriculture. We're talking about folks who live in very rural parts of the country. And, you know, it's going to take miles and miles until they come into contact with someone. Or folks who are in domestic work, that's like in the privacy of someone's home. And don't have contact with anyone. They are under constant surveillance. And so how do you create an opportunity for them to access other people?
And how did they escape?
So the majority of the people in our sample, 59% escaped by running away. And the second most common way of escape was through the support of a friend. And, you know, I think it's important to recognize that for folks who have to be under constant surveillance, and there's physical barriers or psychological abuse from the traffickers. There's a very complicated relationship with law enforcement because of their immigration status. They are relying on narrowed windows of surveillance to escape. You know, we had a situation where a woman, you know, the trafficker left the door open and she just ran out and ran and, you know, waved down a cab. That was one of the stories we heard. And for other folks who are working in maybe a more populated setting like hospitality, they are relying on a network or a support of like friends or colleagues who could help them, you know, being more strategic about their exit, helping them find a way to escape. So it's, you know, I can't emphasize the importance of bystanders in this process of escape. A lot of times it took just someone who, you know, to stop someone on the street and say, like, you know, there's something off. Like, what is going on here? And them having, you know, the power to contact law enforcement to check on the situation. And I think that's really, really important.
Nobody's taking them. Nobody from the criminal justice system is taking them back to the trafficker, are they? Well, they're not making that mistake, are they?
Well, so we did have one person that we interviewed, and she actually was able to call 911. And when law enforcement arrived, they interviewed both the trafficker and the victim, and they sided with the trafficker. And they actually told the victim that if she called law enforcement or 911 again, she would go to prison.
Yeah, exactly. And there was another case where an agricultural worker was shot at by the trafficker farmer. And basically, then he was arrested and put into deportation proceedings because his visa had expired. And it's all as a result of the trafficking experience that happens.
I'm just hoping that people who have listened long enough to this program at this stage of the game are now beginning to get a sense as to what we mean by human trafficking. You know, I just get the sense that it's not taken seriously. It's people see it as a matter of a labor dispute, and it's not. Mm-hmm. It's bondage. Mm-hmm. It's bondage in the United States. All right. So, what's the role of the public to get them to understand how difficult this is? What should we do? Not just the criminal justice system, but the general public.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think as Isela mentioned, one of the things that we found that was so important was the role of bystanders and how much they were actually involved. And sometimes there were unrealized opportunities for escape. So, you know, we heard from survivors that, for example, they were out cutting the grass with scissors, a domestic worker, at 4 a.m. And, you know, a neighbor was coming home and saw that, and they tried to reach out. And maybe they had, you know, limited English capacity, but they were at least able to communicate that something was wrong. And it was an unrealized opportunity for escape. Other stories we heard, they would, you know, ask neighbors for help, but they might say, I don't want to get involved. So there were these opportunities where folks were reaching out. What's really key to really understand, I think, and what is different in some cases from what we see with sex trafficking is that in our sample, at least, of labor trafficking victims, about 96% of all of the victims that we looked at in our case files actually realized something was wrong and that they didn't call it labor trafficking. They didn't say, I'm a victim of labor trafficking, but often they would say things like, I realized I'm being tricked and I realized, you know, that I'm being coerced. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's an opportunity where they are reaching out for help. They do realize something is wrong, and it's getting the resources and the awareness out there so that we can actually capitalize on that and get people the help they need.
But maybe it's the term. I mean, I'm not quite sure that I even understand. I've been in the criminal justice system for 45 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not quite sure I understand labor trafficking. Mm-hmm. Human trafficking gets me somewhat to where I need to be, and that's why I'm constantly bringing up this sense of bondage because of that, and that's what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So isn't that what we need to get across to the American public? I mean, we're talking about human beings in bondage.
Right. I mean, but I think we also need to pay close attention to the psychological forms of coercion, because sometimes this the focus on bondage is important, and it's important to underscore the fact that, you know, people are laboring against their will. But sometimes I think people get hung up because they might see a case, for example, of a domestic worker, and they might say, well, why don't they just leave? Or they're a farmer. Why don't they just leave? Why do they stay? And it's really important to understand all of the mechanisms that are being used against them to compel them to stay. The difference with slavery of the past is that people aren't in chains for the most part. But there are other forms of coercion that are being used to keep them in bondage. So,
but the same question is being asked of domestic violence victims. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to suggest that the question is repulsive. I understand that the question may be somewhat natural, but they don't understand all the complexities involved in this. And this is bondage. Mm-hmm. This is psychological bondage in terms of domestic violence. It sounds exactly like the same thing is happening here. Mm-hmm. You can entrap a human being in chains, but those chains could be psychological. If the trafficker is going to say that your kids are going to be sold off, or, you know, I'm going to make sure that your family back in Guatemala goes through utter and complete hell, and I'm going to make sure that they have no livelihood if you continue fighting me, that is just as strong as of a chain.
Right. And exactly. And back, I think, to your original question, I mean, it's important then for the public to understand that. And so awareness campaigns need to be created that really highlight right, not just are you a victim of labor trafficking, but have you experienced these things? And if so, you know, here's the number to call.
You know, again, it's just an amazing report. Understanding the organization, operation, and victimization process of labor trafficking in the United States. Our guest today, Colleen, you bring a sense of real insight in terms of this. And so it's the second time that you've been here, but you're always welcome back. Justin
you.
And Isela, both of you guys really appreciate your being here. Again, it's a program or an effort, research effort by the Northeastern University, by the Urban Institute, and by the U.S. Department of Justice. You can find the report on the website of the Urban Institute, www.urban.org, www.urban.org. Ladies and gentlemen, this is DC Public Safety. We appreciate your comments. We even appreciate your criticisms, and we want everybody to have yourselves a very, very pleasant day.